It's Friday, January 13th, 2017, and this is WFYI's Weekly News Roundup. I'm Taylor Bennett. Indiana's 51st governor was sworn in on Monday.
I, Eric J. Holcomb,
swear that I will support the Constitution.
Swear that I will support the Constitution.
Governor Holcomb will be the featured guest on Indiana Lawmakers coming up at 1:30. Holcomb wasn't the only official sworn in. Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch, Attorney General Curtis Hill, Auditor Tara Klutz, and State Superintendent of Public Instruction Jennifer McCormick took the oaths of office in front of a crowd of about 3,000 at the state fairgrounds. Proposed legislation would end the state's controversial ISTEP exam in 2018. But as Eric Weddle reports, no one knows what the replacement will be yet.
The legislation calls for a new statewide assessment program named ILEARN, Indiana's Learning Evaluation Assessment Readiness Network. It will go into effect for the 2018-19 school year. But lawmakers and state education leaders now have to figure out what the test will be like. It could be designed from scratch or be a so-called off-the-shelf test purchased and adapted for Indiana. State Superintendent Jennifer McCormick says state leaders must have the courage to consider all options.
Everything's on the table right now with that review, though I know the legislators are anxious. We're having conversation with them. It's been very open at this point, so that's very promising. But we'll move forward with assessment as well. But no decision has been made as far as what that next step will be.
If the bill is approved, Indiana students will continue taking the current ISTEP exam for the next 2 years. For 90.1 WFYI News, I'm Eric Weddle.
A measure that raises taxes to expand public transportation was introduced to the City-County Council this week, the start of its path to possibly becoming law. As WFYI's Drew Dodlin reports, supporters of the measure feel good about its chances.
In November, Marion County voters approved the measure to raise local income taxes to pay for expanded mass transit with 60% of the vote. A majority of voters in 19 of the 25 districts voted to approve the referendum, and the measure needs 13 votes to pass. But Republican Councilman Jeff Miller says details about the plan, such as the size of its tax increase, currently set at 0.25%, could change as it moves through committee hearings over the next 2 months.
Ultimately, I hope that people understand our city is facing great poverty. We see it in the homicide rate, we see it in our crime rate, we see it in how many people are not making livable wage jobs. This is not the silver bullet, but it's huge.
Critics say better mass transit is needed in Indy, but that the measure is more of a pipe dream than a practical plan. The council is scheduled to vote on the measure February 27th. For 90.1 WFYI News, I'm Drew Dodlin.
Semi caused some major troubles for drivers when the semi driver crashed into a bridge at Rockville Road. The northbound lanes of I-465 were closed because of major damage to the bridge. NDOT spokesman Will Wingfield.
Mobile car crusher had some type of issue that required its hydraulic equipment to be raised and to strike the bridge. There are 14 beams that support Rockville Road over both directions of I-465. Four of those beams over northbound traffic only are damaged. We're working right now with some contractors who are mobilizing on site to make some repairs. It'll be a two-step response for us. The first will be a short-term reopening of as much as we can safely, as soon as we can. The second will be a long-term repair, which will be longer-term in nature.
Several vehicles were also damaged by falling debris. One driver was hospitalized with minor injuries. Indianapolis Mayor Joe Hogsett selected a 26-year veteran of the city's police department this week as its new leader.
Brian Roach joined IMPD as a beat officer in 1991 and worked his way up through the ranks to become the department's chief administrator. He says trust and transparency are essential to policing and that he's committed to the community policing initiatives rolled out under his predecessor, Troy Riggs.
I want you to know who I am. I want you to know what our police department stands for, and I want that trust, that community, so that we can work together.
Deputy Chief Val Cunningham, who filled in briefly for Riggs after he resigned at the end of December, says she campaigned for Roach to have the job.
We both see this as such an opportunity for our agency to continue on a positive path uninterrupted. Chief Riggs set us on an excellent path. Chief Roach will go down that path with the accelerator floored.
For 90.1 WFYI News, I'm Michelle Johnson.
You're listening to WFYI's Weekly News Roundup. I'm Taylor Bennett. The new Indiana Reproductive Justice Coalition delivered 3,000 signatures to the governor's office this week, stating opposition to a new bill that would ban abortions. Harmony Glenn is with Indy Feminist, and she says last year's court ruling against parts of the 2016 abortion law gave her hope.
But here we are, a week into the session, with our lawmakers entering their first committee meetings to hear the bills that have been filed. And once more, our rights are being debated.
The coalition also highlighted bills they do support, like hate crime legislation and raising the minimum wage. About 250,000 people gain coverage under HIP 2.0, but as Side Effects Public Media's Jake Harper reported, it's not working for everybody.
Verma added a conservative twist to Medicaid expansion. Instead of just signing up for coverage, recipients have to make monthly payments.
And if they fall behind on their payments, they can get disenrolled.
David Mocklett is a policy analyst with the National Health Law Program. Now, to be clear, if you make below the federal poverty level,
about $12,000,
you don't lose your insurance entirely. You get bumped down to a lower level of coverage. But if you're above the poverty line, you're locked out for 6 months. It's complicated. And Mocklett says many people on HIP 2.0 don't understand how it works.
I think one of the big lessons of the Indiana program is that people have been very confused by it, by the structure of how the program is designed.
Even if you do everything right, you pay your bills on time each month, you could still lose coverage because the state and insurers running HIP 2.0 are making mistakes. Alan Wilson was an over-the-road truck driver for 38 years before his health issues forced him into retirement. First, he had heart problems.
Well, I had open-heart surgery in 2009.
Then his kidneys started to fail.
I'm like one step from being on dialysis.
And he has diabetes. So Wilson needs coverage. He signed up for HIP 2.0 in 2015 and paid his bills each month. But he says one time when he went to the doctor, they told him, "You're not covered." He says he called his insurance company, Anthem, and they told him he missed a payment.
My wife's like, "Excuse me." Well, she keeps the receipts. She pulls that out and said, "Well, right here's the invoice number, when we sent it, the whole thing."
But he says this kept happening. Bills that should have been covered went unpaid. He and his wife were frustrated.
She finally told him straight out, "Are you trying to kill my husband? Is this what you're doing?"
Eventually, they got help from an attorney.
Catherine Wood, I'm an attorney at Indiana Legal Services.
ILS is a nonprofit that provides free legal help to the poor. Wood handles a lot of HIP 2.0 cases.
The reason we win appeals with our clients is because our clients did everything correctly from the beginning.
Attorneys with ILS say they've appealed and resolved dozens of cases where the state or insurance companies made mistakes that got people kicked off of HIP. But those could be just a fraction of what's out there. State reports show thousands of people have been kicked off of their HIP coverage for missing a monthly payment. But if a HIP client actually made that payment, they may not know they can appeal or that they can get help through organizations like ILS. The state declined to be interviewed for this story, but advocates like Wood say these mistakes are inevitable. HIP 2.0 is a huge bureaucracy, a government organization working with insurance companies.
Trying to service hundreds of thousands of people, and things fall through the cracks.
And without that requirement for monthly payments, people like Alan Wilson wouldn't lose coverage. Even when a judge sides with her clients, Wood says it doesn't always help. Alan Wilson eventually got on Medicare, but Anthem still hasn't paid some of the bills he accrued when he should have been covered by HIP 2.0.
How much money are we talking?
A few thousand dollars.
Do you have debt collectors coming after you or anything?
Oh, I've been called, yes. What else can I say, but I'm probably never going to have the money to completely straighten you out. I mean, just not going to happen.
If the insurance company doesn't end up paying, Wilson plans to file bankruptcy. He says it's been a rough road getting to this point, and he's still on that road. Jake Harper, Side Effects Public Media.
This is the Weekly News Roundup on 90.1 WFYI. I'm Taylor Bennett. A faith-based Indianapolis nonprofit plans to build a tiny house village to serve as a transition into housing for the homeless. Food for Souls has a goal to break ground by this October on a tiny home community of 15 to 20 units. Outreach associate Leon Longard says that they've been researching similar communities in Washington, Oregon, Wisconsin, and even Muncie, Indiana. He says there's a huge need to help get more people off the streets.
When you're looking at 144 square feet, is that a permanent housing solution for somebody? I mean, I know people that are living in our camps in down on the river and other places. They've built shacks, and they've been happy there for, you know, 3, 4, 5 years already. So that may be enough for them. But for some people, I think they would get to a point that they would want to move on.
Alan Witchie, the executive director of CHIP, the Coalition for Homelessness Intervention and Prevention, says for people living on the streets, this may be a really good transition for some.
Some people need a bridge. They're not ready to go immediately into permanent housing, and yet there isn't really an option for them to go and wait for a minute until they get a few things together in their lives and then go to a permanent place. And maybe this is an option for that.
He says CHIP is providing guidance to Food for Souls as the Tiny Homes Project develops. Soil sampling continues this winter in the Martindale-Brightwood neighborhood, but removal of lead-contaminated soil is on hold until it's warm enough for backhoes to return. As WFYI's Lee DeNoon reported, this is the second go-around for major lead cleanup in the Near East Side community.
12 years ago, at the direction of the EPA, the National Lead Company removed lead-tainted soil from over 200 lawns adjacent to its former smelter at 21st and Hillside. That smelter shut down in the 1960s and burned. What wasn't known during the first lead cleanup in 2005 was that toxic contamination extended farther into the community than just the wind could have carried it. Experts believe the slag and other lead smelting byproducts were used as fill for lawns throughout the area.
Yeah, the map you see over here, it outlines the cleanup area. We're going to be testing inside that area and outside of that area.
In her temporary field office in the neighborhood a few weeks ago, geologist Shelley Lamb showed where the work is happening. As the on-scene coordinator for the EPA, Lamb wants to test as many lawns as possible to make sure as much tainted soil as possible is removed this time. Soil samples in small glass jars are initially tested for contamination.
So we call this our soil kitchen, and it's our laboratory for processing soil before we send the soil samples to the lab. And we put them in one of the ovens for 2 to 3 hours to drive off moisture.
Once they're dry, they undergo more sophisticated tests to look for the chemical element antimony, which was used in car batteries. And car batteries were smelted here between the 1940s and 1960s. The antimony linked to today's contaminated yards is what was needed to activate the $5 million in EPA superfunds for this cleanup. Outside a home in the neighborhood, Lamb tracked the work of contractors as a backhoe filled a dump truck with soil.
You can see, you know, where they've removed a foot to 2 feet of soil. We test continuously as we're digging. I know we've already tested some of the sidewalls here, confirmed that we don't need to go any further in the directions that we can. And then they've also started testing the bottom.
Neighborhood residents founded the Martindale-Brightwood Environmental Justice Collaborative when high levels of lead were discovered a dozen years ago. Longtime neighborhood resident Elizabeth Gore is the chairperson of the group. She has expressed confidence in Lamb, appreciates weekly EPA status updates, and is satisfied with this cleanup to date.
So what we're looking for this time, because neighbors are a little dubious, is that we will get proper grading, we will get the proper kind of soil put back in the yards. And so far, I've noticed they're doing a better job.
Gore wants to make sure kids today stay healthy and don't play in toxic soil like her kids unknowingly did.
It doesn't give you a very good feeling to know that your children were playing in lead. And so in this neighborhood, we know that there are some learning disabilities. We understand that there are some health issues.
Through the Healthy Homes program, the Marion County Health Department offers free lead testing for young children who live in or visit the neighborhood. 28 of the 48 contaminated lawns identified so far have been removed and replaced with clean fill. While the current funds will remediate about 100 lawns, Lamb says sampling continues to see if the area qualifies for the EPA National Priorities List.
If it scores and is placed on the National Priorities List, that will bring a great deal of funding for cleanup.
And if it doesn't qualify, but the need still exceeds current funding, she will apply for more. For 90.1 WFYI News, I'm Lee Danoon.
Community groups on the east side of Indianapolis won a National Redevelopment Award from the Environmental Protection Agency. Near East Area Renewal Director John Hay says that the $200,000 grant is a significant first step towards redeveloping the Indy East Promise Zone. He says the EPA money will fund community planning.
For instance, an educational facility, or part of it to be a park, or part of it to be a commercial site or an industrial site, or a combination of these.
He says planning will take several years. This is the weekly news roundup on WFYI.
What do you wonder about Indianapolis?
Why did Pogues Run get buried underground?
Why are there so many potholes?
Who's in charge of synchronizing all the stoplights in town?
With Curious Indy, you can ask questions and help WFYI News decide what we should be reporting on next, and sometimes even be part of finding the answer. So, Curious Indy? Go to WFYI.org/Curious Indy to find out more.
Thanks to a successful reintroduction program at Lake Monroe in Bloomington during the late 80s, bald eagle sightings are much more common in Indiana. DNR assistant bird biologist Amy Kearns told us this week that the cold winter months are some of the best times to see eagles.
This time of year, once you see one, if you look around, you have a good chance to see another bird. We have some pairs that are already hanging around their nest area, but there are also places where you just have a bunch of young birds, birds that aren't breeding yet, they're still immature, and then you can also have them grouping up with migrants, so birds that typically nest further north that are spending the winter in balmy Indiana. We have some locations, it's not uncommon at all to see 10 or more eagles, and if you're really lucky, we have some sites where you can see 50 or more eagles in one day. We have more eagles in Indiana in January than we do in June. So there are more eagles here. They're concentrated near open water sources, and there's no leaves on the trees, so it's easier to see them.
Several of Indiana's state parks have become the perfect setting for bald eagle congregations, including Lake Monroe. It's interpretive naturalist Jill Vance.
We're kind of the premier spot because this is where it all happened here in Indiana. And they have eagles have definitely made their home here. We actually have a couple of the eagles who are part of the original reintroduction program who are still here at the lake.
The Indiana Department of Natural Resources is providing Eagle Watch programs this month and next for the public to come and see them and learn more. Indiana residents will now officially be known as Hoosiers in all printed federal government documents. A letter sent last year from Indiana lawmakers is the reason for the change.
Last April, a bipartisan letter signed by Indiana's two U.S. senators was sent to the U.S. Government Publishing Office, which produces and prints documents for all three branches of the federal government. It also creates the Federal Style Guide, where Indiana residents were referred to as Indianans. But now, in line with the letter's request, Indiana residents will be Hoosiers in official government documents. In a video announcement on Thursday, Democratic Senator Joe Donnelly says he's pleased with the change, and Republican Senator Todd Young recognizes it's a small victory, but still a victory.
We're not delivering world peace, but we're finally being identified by the federal government as who we are, Hoosiers. It's not just the name of a classic movie. It's not just what we call IU athletics. It's who we are.
Last April's letter pointed out that local newspapers have been using the term Hoosier since 1826. And a poem normalizing the word, The Hoosier's Nest by John Finley, originally appeared in a Richmond newspaper in 1830. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Stephanie Weekman.
It's been a busy week at the Indiana State House. Indiana Lawmakers is next. For 90.1 WFYI News, I'm Taylor Bennett.